Welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. Your co-host today, I'm Dan Rooker, and we have Ben Lacomas.
Hey, everyone. Really excited to be a co-host today. A few weeks ago in the 210th episode, we had Lauren and Megan going over a really lovely checklist for 2023 and provided a lot of good student loan updates and financial planning updates. Dan and I thought it would be good fun for today's podcast episode to dig a bit deeper into some of those topics and to really give you guys some good thoughts going into the new year.
And let's also pick a theme for 2023. I was thinking earlier this morning to call it save like it's 2020, kind of like party like it's 1999. I think that 2020 was a pretty phenomenal year in the world of savings rates for many reasons, some of them forced, some of them out of, couldn't travel, that kind of thing. But I was looking at national average savings rates, and 2020 was a pretty high year. If you define savings rate as a percentage of your gross income, that is before taxes, then 2020 was probably something like 14%. And prior years before that, you know, over the past decade and going further back, it's ranged from 5 to 7%. So savings rate, percentage of gross income, 5 to 7% of your income is going towards things that improve your net worth over time. So 2020 was a pretty big year. Sure, there was a financial crash. And if we go back to the past financial crash in 2008, 2009, 2010, savings rates weren't that high. So there isn't a direct relationship between the two. I think you had market crashes in both timelines, but 2020 was special in that everyone stayed at home. But also our student loan payments paused. You know, student loan payments didn't pause in 08, 09, and 2010. A lot of people may have forced them to pause individually, but we didn't have a national shutdown of student loan payments.
Yeah, it's interesting. Maybe the pandemic really kept people wanting to save. But however it happened, the statistics are phenomenal on it. And today's episode, we're going to talk about savings rates, some updated savings contribution rates for retirement accounts and some other common savings buckets we've gotten into before. We're going to detail a bit again today. So we'll go over some examples of where you could be saving in 2023 and stick into our savings slash party theme of saving very aggressively for the year. And then I think we'll wrap with a little punch list. I know every episode for the last year has sounded like there's been a ton of changes and differences. Today, we promise we'll keep that list a little smaller. As always, there's updates. That's why you're listening, but nothing too crazy and exhaustive on that front. Right, Dan?
No, definitely not. Hopefully not too exhaustive. I mean, yeah. You and I know we're both analytics. We can talk to a stone and be happy.
Yeah, well, with the exhaustion of a lot of what's happened in 2022 behind us, what are you looking forward to for 2023 before we dive into these topics here together?
2023, my spouse, Ketsy, and I are going on a trip to Guatemala in April, and she's adopted. She's from Guatemala. We've never been. So we've been planning that for a while, looking forward to it. I think it's going to be, I'm just going to go in with an open mind. And I am going to try to plan it. I think in past travel trips we've taken together, she's done the majority of the planning. And I'd like to take a more active role this time and do my research, catch up on Duolingo, that kind of thing.
Did you get your year-end definition of how your Duolingo participation's gone?
I did. It doesn't look good so far.
Well, I'm sure everyone's been checking in on that and their Spotify's and such. I know I did. Always fun. But looking forward instead of behind, I think 2023 is going to be a wonderful year. I think in line with the theme, I've got a lot of personal financial growth and planning to take to on my end. So going to be upping my savings rate number, as we'll be chatting about today. Well, not so much me specifically, but we'll say as the general audience will be doing as well, all of you listening. Me personally, it's going to be a year of that, going to be a year of getting my CFP nailed down, kind of the gold standard designation for planners in the industry. And while I've always worked with one, I think it's worked with one or multiple, it's time for me to make that hurdle too. So I'll still be focusing on on student loans, helping people crush their student loan debt best they can. But ultimately, I gotta keep my financial planning cap shined as well. So
sounds good.
That's what I'm looking forward to. Long nights of studying.
We'll be there. The team will be there. If you have questions, some of us other CFPs.
Yeah, you're all multi-credentialed, and I'm getting there. It's time. So student loans are always a focus when you know how tremendously understanding them can help people, but financial planning, savings, investing, risk management, the 100 other buckets that fall within the purview of how people can better their financial lives and financial wellness, I need to hone in on again. So I'm excited for that. And I think that's a great segue to get right into it here. Up first, we agreed to talk about savings rates. And I know there's a lot of really important things to cover within just saving, and it's probably the most obvious path to anyone really growing towards financial success and security and wellness is having savings. But let's really define what a savings rate is and how that comes up in many of our consultations, which are obviously student loan planning focused, but general financial wellness and how to build a student loan plan into your financial plan is crucial. So a savings rate, most simply defined, is what you save on an annual basis divided by your gross income. And Dan, why don't you talk about how the savings rate comes into play when we're running consultations for Student Loan Planner?
Yeah, sure. So at the end of the consult, maybe the last 15 minutes of a consult, just depends on how many questions we have at the front end. And I will say that a lot of our consults have a lot of questions coming in. So for a lot of consults, what you may have experienced is the net worth calculator never came up because there was so much to cover on the front end. I think the net worth calculator often comes up in follow-up consults because you're hitting the ground running at the beginning. So there's this tab in our student loan calculator at the end of a consult that our consults get as follow-up called the net worth calculator. And what it does is it incorporates the student loan strategy that you pick and that you can toggle between different student loan strategies, whether it's on an income-driven plan or on some fixed payment plan or refinanced plan. And it will overlay what you make, subtract out student loan payments, insert savings, and tell you when work becomes optional down the road. And your savings rate is one of the inputs on that calculator, along with other things like how much do you spend every year, how much do you have so far, that kind of thing. And it's what we find and what we illustrate and why we built that tab is that your savings rate is one of the levers that has a lot of impact. It's most impactful to when work becomes optional. And when work becomes optional, I guess we could define, like, how would you define financial independence, Ben?
Yeah, I'd say the line I always use when I'm talking to physicians is it's when you could hang up the proverbial white coat and live your desired lifestyle without fear of running out of money or not reliant on a paycheck anymore. So remove the white coat from the equation. I'd say it applies to everyone when you no longer rely on an employer to live your life.
Yeah, for sure. And that number that you need in financial planning, financial services, we use the 4% rule, or same way said, is 25 times your annual number, the amount that you need. And that's out there. You can find it on Google. But what that number is different for everybody. And what it is today may be different than it is in the future. But if we use today as a proxy, and that's what we do in consults, is we just say, let's use today's spending. How do you get to spending? Well, you've got what you make, you've got what you saved every year, and what's left over goes to pay taxes, and then you live on the rest. When we stop working one day and we pull money out of retirement accounts, unless it's all Roth, unless it's all HSA or tax-free, we're going to pay taxes before we live on it. So just take what you make, take what you save, and that's your number.
Yeah. And I think a really cool reason to focus on that number personally, and I'm sure this bleeds into all other sorts of life advice, but you want to control what you can control. And that's often the best path forward, other than really things like inflation, taxes. You don't have much control there. You've got control over what you can save, and that best arms you against some future uncertainty. And I think if the last couple of years have taught anyone anything, it's that uncertainty is ever constant. And I think pandemic lifestyle, student loan pause, these are all changes. I remember I read the word unprecedented in about 1,000 news articles in 2020, because everything was unprecedented change. Well, savings rate is the best way over a career and a lifetime to build yourself and do the best you can do, control what you can do towards reaching that financial independence.
Yeah. And I think that we should define savings for ourselves here. As student loan consultants, we do include your student loan payments and your tax bill, tax bomb payments as part of your savings. So if you're trying to think about, okay, like what is my savings rate? Like I said before, take what you make and then add up what you save. Define save as anything that improves my net worth over time. And at some point in time, if you're on a forgiveness plan, your loans are forgiven, you pay your tax bill maybe, and your net worth goes up. If you were to pay your loans down to zero, you pay them down, your net worth gradually goes up. And I would take that as a different type of savings because you're paying down debt, but it's not the same as consumer debt, like car loans, furniture loans, credit card debt. Those things were taken out for transportation or lifestyle needs or entertainment. And that's very different from something that you took out, whether you knew what you were doing or not, as an investment in your future earnings. So you're taking out student debt, paying it back, I would consider part of your savings rate. And then you have traditional things like retirement account savings at work, cash, rental real estate, reinvestment in your practice, whatever it may be. I'd even throw in extra mortgage payments. The first mortgage payment is like rent. That's what puts a roof over our heads. But the second mortgage payment is pushing the ball forward each month and improving your net worth over time. So if that's your savings and you add all that up, take that, divide that by what you make as a household, there's your savings rate. And what we found in the net worth calculator is that the savings rate really impacts the timeline. If you have a national average of the past decade savings rate of 5 to 7%, work is optional in like 50 years. If you have a, I'll pay my tax bomb savings and my income-driven payment, and I'm putting enough to get in the match at work, then work is optional in probably 35 to 40 years. And if you save 30%, work is optional in maybe 25 years. If you save 50%, live on one salary, save the other, if you both make the same amount, then work is optional in 15 years. In all of those scenarios, if we were to forgive your loans today, it might swing the timeline 1 to 3 years. So there's this savings rate and how it swings the timeline, the impact of your savings rate, the impact of your student loans. This isn't to undermine the benefit of having an informed plan on your student loans. I think we're still talking about tens of thousands of dollars in savings by making an informed decision on your student loans. But just to put into perspective with the long term, the savings rate is huge. So I think now that it's figured out, where can we put the money? I think we should talk about that for sure.
Yeah, I think that's a particularly exciting conversation since the recent podcast. The IRS has posted the always much anticipated updates of where you can put money next year for 2023. And what I mean by that is certain accounts that, you know, savings good for everybody, savings good for you, but more important, it's good for the economy. And the government likes when you save for particular things. They don't want our retired population to have no assets to take care of themselves. So they reward you to save for retirement. You get tax breaks by putting money into your 401k or 403b through tax deferral, or if you're doing a Roth version, being tax-free. But those benefits aren't endless and unlimited, as we all know. So they're willing to reward us, but those contribution caps are there every year to keep us in line with how much tax-advantaged money we can save. Because you can really put an unlimited amount if you have it. I don't. But you can put an unlimited amount of money into, you know, your savings accounts, non-qualified, non-retirement investment accounts. But when it comes to saving for things like retirement, health-related savings, education-related things, things that are generally productive, we have those caps to adhere to. So talking through some of those biggest updates just for you can for you to be aware of where you can put money. 401k and 403b contribution limits have been updated. Roth IRAs, IRAs, really all of the retirement savings vehicles and 457bs. So talking through what some of those are individually here, just really going to list them out.
Yeah. So the 401k, 403b, and 457 maximums in 2021 and 2022, well, we'll just go with 2022, were $20,500 each. A $20,500 for a 401k or a 403b, can't double up on those, but $20,500 in addition to the 401k or 403b for the 457. If you're over the age of 50, for the 401k or 403b, it was $6,500. Those caps have been raised. So 2023 maximum is $22,500 and add on $7,500 if you're over the age of 50. So if you're listening to this podcast, you've got Parent Plus loans, maybe you've just booked your consult with Megan and figured it out how to limit that payment. Maybe there's room to up your 401k contribution and you could put $30,000 away every year. And that doesn't count the employer match.
Wow. Yeah, that's a big jump. The health savings account jump also went up. So if you're using your HSA or health savings account, definitely something that's come up in our past consults in past podcasts, because it is one of those really attractive options for you to make a contribution to that then reduces your AGI or adjusted gross income, which lowers your student loan payment. But the amount you can contribute to an HSA in 2023 for a family has been increased to $7,300. Divide that by two for individuals or $3,650. I won't make you do math on your drive. So I think that one is probably one of the most exciting ones. I contribute to an HSA myself. And then you mentioned 401k and 403b. We still got to cover the Roth contributions, right?
Yeah. So I think some people are, you know, maybe they've read a blog post on our site about backdoor Roth IRAs, or they've read on NerdWallet or some other site about Roth IRAs. And the Roth portion of a 401k also exists, and it doesn't have any sort of earnings limit, especially if you're filing married, filing separately. Like, if you have a Roth 403b or 401k, Roth 401k option at work, it hasn't been around a long time, not nearly as long as the traditional 401k portion, the part that, you know, you put money in, you don't pay federal income taxes or you don't pay state income taxes. And a Roth 401k, you do pay those taxes, but you get the same benefits as a Roth IRA in that the growth of that account is tax-free, the growth of that portion of that account. So if you have that option, it's either $22,500 Roth or $22,500 traditional or some combination of the two, and the total is $22,500. You know, kick it back to the health savings account though, because why are you saving in a health savings account, Ben?
Well, the health savings account, some people are even more attracted to it potentially than a Roth IRA. It gives you a lot of flexibility, but if you're in a high deductible health plan, which, you know, it's individual for everyone, but oftentimes appropriate for people who are younger and healthier, as long as you have savings that could handle a decent out-of-pocket expense. But you get a low monthly premium for health insurance, and then the option to open up what's called this HSA, health savings account. The money you put into it is generally tax deductible and then can be used for qualified health expenses tax-free. And ultimately, there's a similar vehicle called an FSA or a flexible spend account that the money has to be spent within a calendar year. And I hear that a lot for HSAs too, but that's mistaken. And your HSA account can actually roll over annually. So it's a place where you can put in tax-deferred contributions, use it for health expenses if you need it, because you are on that high deductible plan to have access to this. But ultimately, if it's unused for health expenses, you can grow that account towards your retirement goals, and it could be actually converted into a retirement account without losing that tax efficiency.
I think that's huge. I'd call that triple tax-free. It's like the holy grail of investment accounts. I don't think we have a blog post on it. We should probably get a blog post going on it.
Not to plug us anymore to our listeners, but we have a blog post on everything. I'm sure there's some degree of health savings blog post out there, but if not, you'll see one coming soon from Dan or Ben, that's for sure.
So on the earnings limits or contributions limits, the traditional IRA and the Roth IRA, kind of like the traditional 401k and Roth 401k limits, they have an aggregate cap. So you can put up to $6,500 in 2023. It used to be 6,000. So, and it's gone up over time. Before that, it was 5,500 and 5,000 before that. So $6,500 in 2023 could be put into a traditional IRA or into a Roth IRA, not both. You could do 3,000 and 3,500 in one or the other, and maybe total, but not both.
Wow. So we've got 22,500 for 401ks, 403bs, and separately for the 457, that same 22,500, but that one, they're not commingled, if you will, those limits. I'm not sure what the best way to say this would be, Dan, but they don't interfere with one another. You could put 22,500 in a 401k and in a 457 plan. We've got the Roth IRAs and IRAs at 6,500, and then the HSAs at 7,300 for the family and 3,650 for individuals. So definitely lots of savings options out there to meet our theme and to up those savings rates for everybody.
For sure. Yeah, Ben, you were telling me earlier before we started recording this about something new that I hadn't heard about. And there's a lot I haven't heard about, but I tend to keep my head down in the sand when it comes to financial planning things. And I'm trying to keep my head up and listen to current news, but you seem to be on the ball with the newest stuff.
I wouldn't hold yourself. There's too much student loan news happening every week for any of us to keep our heads on straight. But the Secure 2.0 Act was just recently redetailed, if you will, or some new pieces have come out there. And potentially one of the more interesting pieces, at least for some of you in our audience, is that the Secure 2.0 Act will allow employers to match into a retirement plan based on what you're contributing to your student loans. So Dan before said student loans, you know, are potentially something that we push into our savings rate. Well, this really makes that even more so the case if your employer does offer that. But essentially, if you're contributing $350 a month to your student loan payment, maybe your savings elsewhere is tight, and you'd have to make some sacrifices in order to be able to save for retirement as well. Hopefully that's not the case, but paying your student loans, maybe it's hard to save elsewhere. In this case, your student loan or your employer could match that $350 student loan contribution or whatever it is with a match dollar that goes into your 401k or 403b and is invested for you towards retirement. So when we talk about savings, or really when any financial planner talks about savings, the first thing you'll hear outside of having an emergency fund is making sure you take advantage of your match, which is if you put a dollar in, they put a dollar in, or maybe some fraction of it. But now you don't have to make the decision if you're tighter on cash flow between potentially going into forbearance or something else on your student loans just to be able to save for retirement. You could make student loan contributions, and through the Secure 2.0 Act, your employer can actually match those contributions. So really exciting way for people who are maybe a little bit more cash flow stressed to make sure you're getting some progress towards retirement while still prioritizing your student loans.
I think that has some huge implications for the incentives that are out there. I mean, we talk about in student loan consults about how your income-driven repayment plan calculation is based off of your adjusted gross income. And then we talk about putting money into your 401k or 403b into the traditional side is going to reduce your income to bring your adjusted gross income down. And that means less in student loan payments. So less in taxes, less in student loan payments, more in net worth, win, win, win. This is another thing that is just more reason, I think, to save by paying down your student loans. I mean, if you're putting away 7 to 10% of your income towards an income-driven plan, and your employer can match, I don't know what the number is going to work out to, but 7 to 10% of your income into a 401k, that's huge, especially when, you know, we're used to seeing employers that match 3 to 6% off of contributions. There are some exceptions out there, but if they were to do something like that, that would be huge. And this is going to come down to the individual company, by the way. So for those of you listening, it's not like across the board, all employers are going to start matching into your 401k. It's their choice, but you are a valued employee of that organization. And I would advocate either by yourself or with a group of people when this comes through to make it a benefit, because you're probably not alone. There are a lot of borrowers out there, and it may be a taboo topic to bring up student loans at work, but know that there's a good chance that, you know, you and every second or third person out there at your company has student loans.
Yeah. You know, if you're working with a smaller, medium-sized company, it might be a scary topic to think about bringing up to someone in HR or someone who potentially even owns the company. But I wouldn't let yourself have that fear, because if it's something that would be beneficial and productive for you, and you're an employee and a valued employee, and there's other people like you at that firm who maybe have similar concerns and it's going to benefit them, then this is really something that employers can offer as, you know, a retention vehicle. And if you're bringing your boss or HR, you know, something that helps with employee retention as an idea, well, the employee retention is pretty important to them, because it's expensive really in most industries to have turnover on your employees. So, you know, the idea might not, it's not just going to sound like, give me more money, but it's, you know, it's a good idea to increase employee retention, happiness, and have employers showing their employees that they care about them. So I do think that is a really exciting topic and an interesting piece that maybe will help drive that savings rate and, you know, some of the retirement balance statistics up that we financial planning nerds happen to look up time and time and again.
Yeah. So we've covered the easy stuff, the numbers you can Google, the savings rate impact, the little bit of insight into the end of our student loan consults and the net worth calculator. But we haven't talked at all about how to prioritize these types of accounts or these savings buckets. And like Ben said, there's so many different types of places or accounts that you can use to improve your net worth over time. It can be a little confusing or a little stressful just figuring out how to divvy up your money. What do you think?
I'll always fall back to say, you know, remember, rules of thumb aren't a fit for everyone. So it really is where, you know, beyond whatever rule of thumb I'm about to give, you should probably consult someone, you know, personally for your exact situation. But I think just balance is important. And anytime I see someone without any degree of balance in their financial plan, it's a problem. Whether money is just only going into savings, or it's only going towards student loans, or it's only going towards retirement, any of those onlys or those extremes are bad. But typically, I find people prioritize, if they have access to it, something like, obviously, first the match. Can't miss that one. We already said that's the golden ticket of free money. Nowhere else are you going to get free money.
Student loan match.
Yeah. And if it's a student loan match, well, that sounds cool too. But obviously, if you could pay your student loans plus make contributions into a retirement account that are matched, both of those are a phenomenal start. Generally, again, it's all individual, but people will tend to use their HSAs or Roth IRAs after that, just depending what type of tax advantage they're looking for, and then would tend more towards those other employer-sponsored accounts, generally 401ks and 403bs and 457s. But it really is, you know, something you should consult your personal financial professional or plan sponsor over, or really get a financial planner that's tuned in to help you create a balance, because tilting into any one of those buckets without filling multiple could leave you with an unsecure financial plan, which is always something we want to avoid.
Yeah. And to add on to that, I think there's a lot of imbalance out there. When I come across someone's financial situation and I'm looking at how they've organized and where they put money, it's heavily tilted towards one spouse's opinion. And that opinion is heavily tilted towards what they know or are comfortable with. And then there's very little in the places that they don't know a lot about and aren't comfortable with. So like the spreadsheet, it's really, it's like this onion you got to peel back. It's multi-layered. You've got the spreadsheet answer, which says most tax efficient to least tax efficient. That's the order of buckets that you fill. You know, so start with the HSA and end with the least tax efficient type of investment vehicle. But a layer above that, you've got to layer on safety and security, liquidity. You know, you need an emergency fund, even though it's not tax efficient, even though it doesn't grow. Yeah. The purpose is, it serves its own purpose. And then you've got another layer above that of medium-term and near-term goals, large expenses coming up. Like, it probably makes sense to save for a down payment in a high-yield savings account. Probably doesn't make sense to save for that in an investment account, especially, and not in a 401k, if you need to spend it here in the next couple of years.
Yeah. I think when I talk to people in their 20s and 30s, most often what I see is a plan that's built for today and for retirement. It's almost like they don't intend to have a middle of their life where there's any non-retirement or non-emergency fund investments. But, you know, you do want to have that balance. You want to have your today money, your intermediate term, and that long term, and not just focus on one or two of those, but really have a well-rounded financial life. And I think one of the updates we can transition into here pretty easily, because it's going to help you continue to increase the savings rate over the next few months, hopefully, is something that was brought up in the prior podcast or two, but there has been an update and some more clarity on posted through studentaid.gov. So for those of you on income-driven repayment plans, any of the IDR plans, there was an update posted on studentaid.gov regarding when you have to actually recertify your income by. And if you're in a plan, hopefully you've already known that for the past while, I'd say past couple months or since the prior pause extension was announced, it was previously saying that if your date for IDR recertification showed anything before July 2023, that it would be pushed out a full calendar year. So no one had to recertify income until July 2023. It's still the case that no one has to do it now, but that might go even further. And I think the language around how they released how far it's going to be pushed back is a little confusing. So the recertification deadline paragraph on studentaid.gov for their announcements reads, you won't be required to recertify before payments restart, and the earliest you could be required to recertify is 6 months after the payment pause ends. Well, the payment pause ending, as we mentioned in the last podcast or two, is kind of fixed to when student loan payments actually begin and what happens with the Supreme Court case in 2023. So theoretically, student loan pause could be extended through the end of August. If they resume on September 1st, that means for IDR recertification purposes that if your payment date is anything from September or from now to potentially 6 months after September 23, February 2024, it could be pushed back 12 months from there, which is insanely long, considering some people are still using their 2018 or 2019 tax return for IDR purposes. We are now seeing that, based on the studentaid.gov language, that some of these recertification dates are going to be pushed back to January or February of 2025, assuming the student loan pause does continue all the way through August. So that means someone who maybe is listening to this and is in medicine and pursuing PSLF, they were a resident or maybe even in medical school for their 18 or 19 return, entered IDR and still have that payment amount set for when payments resume. And that could be pushed all the way until 2025 with this new update. So saying that more clearly, since we did a nice little jumble of words there, recertification dates, no one who's in an IDR plan needs to recertify now. And if your date falls within 6 months of when payments restart, it's getting pushed back a calendar year.
Yep. No one with direct loans needs to recertify now. If you don't have direct loans, I would check out the income-driven repayment waiver page, check out our blog post, book a consult with us. There's probably a compelling reason to not have direct loans. That's not to say that every single case we come away and say, you need to consolidate your FFEL loans. In some people's cases, we leave them alone. And if you're graduating just this next spring, like say you're graduating in May from graduate school, something that I've brought up in a lot of presentations in the past is you don't have to file a tax return, probably. If you're full-time graduate school, you're probably not working. If you're married, you're filing a tax return for sure if your spouse works and you're in grad school. But say you're single and you're graduating this coming April, May, or June, you might not think, oh, I should file a tax return. I didn't have income last year. But I would file one. File one if you intend to get on an income-driven plan. File a tax return in the spring if you want to utilize what you quote-unquote made in 2022 as the calculated payment for the subsequent 12 months. So just hot tip there.
Yeah. If you're making $60,000 in 2023 and you were making nothing in 2022, if you didn't file a tax return and you enter an IDR plan, they'll set your payment to approximately $300, $350 a month, depending what plan you're in. Whereas if you filed a tax return, instead of using that current income or that $60,000, you use your prior year return of $0. It's a phenomenal reason to consult your tax professional, get a tax return in, even if you might not be required to do so, saving yourself, you know, in that little example, $3,600 a year if you're pursuing forgiveness is definitely attractive. Or even if you're not pursuing forgiveness, maybe in your first year of employment, you'd value having a $0 payment so you can work on that emergency fund, that HSA, getting some employer match. Although with Secure 2.0, we've updated that might no longer be a concern there. So
if you're going to enter an income-driven plan in the near future, if you're going to enter an income-driven repayment plan through consolidation, or just you're not consolidating and you want to get on an income-driven plan because you realize, oh, I should be on one to benefit from the income-driven repayment waiver. I've seen in a lot of consults, folks check the box in the application to delay processing until the end of the payment pause. And that defeats the purpose of benefiting from the IDR waiver. So when you're going through the application, elect to start payments immediately. They'll calculate a payment. They'll say that your payment starts next month or 2 months from now. And they'll say, you have this $1,000 payment. Well, that's okay. You want to start in the plan. You want to start participating in the plan. And your payment will be overridden to zero until the payment pause ends.
Yeah, so that's payment pause we all know to be extended. Now we know IDR recertifications pushed back. Definitely a common theme in consolidation mistakes we've seen there. And with the IDR waiver, you certainly don't want to do that. I think the other big update I had for our punch list, which might be relevant for only a small few of you listening, but could be relevant to friends or family too. So If your loans are in default or have had a defaulted status, or you know a family member who's had a defaulted loan, then a few weeks or potentially even months ago at this rate on the podcast, we mentioned what is called Operation Fresh Start. There is an announcement page for it on studentaid.gov. The update to that recently is a little bit exciting, in my opinion, because there's finally been some traction on it. There is now a online application page available for you. So previously on Fresh Start, you'd have to call the default resolution group. And by negotiating a payment plan with them or by entering an income-driven repayment plan, they would remove the defaulted status on your loans, fix your credit. No more wage garnishment, no more any of the terrible stress that comes along with having defaulted student loans can all be uplifted through Fresh Start. Instead of just calling the default resolution group, which is still available as an option, they did release an online application. It is myeddebt.ed.gov. So if you know someone or you are someone with defaulted student loans and you're ready to get the relief that was promised through the Fresh Start program, then you now have the option of doing an online application as well. And you can enter an income-driven repayment plan and you can start benefiting from the IDR waiver. So exciting update there.
Awesome. Thank you, Ben. Well, we're going to close this out. Thank you for listening, everyone. This is the Student Loan Planner Podcast. Keep an eye out for changes. Subscribe to our weekly email. Go to studentloanplanner.com to do that. Book a follow-up consult with us if you need a refresh on your student loan strategy. get a fresh start in 2023 if it applies to you.
Yeah.
Save like it's 2020.
Happy New Year, everybody.